This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Even if you don't know the name M.C. Escher, chances are you've seen his work, a staple of dorm room posters, nerdy neckties, and university math departments. Escher's repeating patterns, impossible objects, and mind-bending optical illusions still have broad universal appeal decades after their creation. A graphic artist by trade, Escher created complex illustrations that have inspired mathematicians and everyday people alike. A new exhibit at the Currier Museum of Art in Manchester is being touted as the largest and most comprehensive retrospective of Escher's work ever shown in the U.S. Jane O'Neill is the Currier Museum's senior educator and did extensive work on the Escher exhibition, and she's with us to talk about Escher's work. Jane, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So a lot of us have seen it. A lot of us know it. But can you describe for our radio audience maybe one famous work that can help people identify M.C. Escher?
Sure. I think a lot of times when people think of M.C. Escher, they might think of the image where it's a drawing of lizards that sort of emerge from the drawing and then become three-dimensional and sort of walk
out
the studio and then go back into the drawing. Escher was known for making these sort of mind-bending images like this.
Now, he was born at a really interesting time, late 19th century, kind of came of age after World War I, left Italy during the rise of the fascists before World War II. A lot of chaos. Did that affect his work?
It sort of moved him around Europe a little bit, but it didn't impact his work too much. Prior to World War II, he was living in Italy and spending a lot of time traveling through Italy, and he made these beautiful landscapes. He was really inspired by the Italian landscape, the architecture there. But after World War II, he moved back to Holland, back to the Netherlands.
He was originally Dutch.
Yes. And so once he went back there and he didn't have that Italian landscape to inspire him anymore, he really turned sort of inside of himself. And he started making much more creative, much more imaginative works.
That's so interesting. I would never think of him as a landscape painter.
I know. There's a lot of surprises in this show. There's a whole gallery full of just incredible prints and drawings of landscapes, highly detailed and really interesting vantage points.
So he moved away from these landscapes to more, I guess, theoretical imagery. Do we know what motivated that? I guess the move.
Yes. So in part the move, and then in part he was really inspired by one site that he had visited in Spain. It's called the Alhambra.
And there's a lot of there. The sort of Moorish, beautiful building and beautiful surrounding area.
Yes. So there's a lot of decorative tile work there, mosaics, and he was fascinated by the patterns there. So he started working on these patterns, these tessellations. They're interlocking. They can go on for as far as the page can stretch. And he worked on those almost obsessively for decades. And so he was really interested in math and the way things sort of fit together like that. He was corresponding with mathematicians all the time and trying to sort of figure these math concepts out in a visual way.
Hmm. Did he have any formal training in math and science?
No formal training in math or science. And he would actually sort of beat himself up about this sometimes. But he really sort of aligned himself more with mathematicians after a while than with artists, because he was so focused on mathematical problems in his work.
The mathematicians, scientists seem to love his work. Engineers seem to love his work. In fact, I've sometimes considered it a kind of, I don't know, analytically minded response rather than an emotional one. Is that fair?
I think it's fair to say that, particularly for a few decades of his work. And we have a big gallery at the museum right now that's filled with these really sort of detailed, carefully drawn, sort of mathematically based works. But then after that, things shift too. And then he goes into sort of more or less impossible worlds, impossible constructions, strange reflections. So he goes from the careful landscapes to that sort of interior, sort of abstract thinking, and then just sort of branches out to something that's much more sort of whimsical and fun, but still kind of based in the math.
Mm-hmm. You know, he's coming of age as an artist during the 50s and 60s, and I'm thinking of, you know, abstract expressionism, you know, different kind of art, things going on in the art world then. Did artists of his day regard him as an artist or as a draftsman?
That's a really interesting question. We don't have a lot of documentation that says that he was interacting with a lot of other artists at this time. And his work is so careful and so precise and so different from the work of the 1950s. I mean, if you're thinking of something like Jackson Pollock and splatter paintings. So, I mean, really, it's during that time that he's most closely aligned with more sort of concrete mathematical thinkers mm-hmm. than with other artists.
Yeah, it's an ordered universe rather than the chaos in some way. He was actually popular when he was alive, which may be a rare thing for a 20th century artist.
Right. So we always think of M.C. Escher as having, you know, the posters in the college dorm rooms mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. The Simpsons, the cartoon, The Simpsons, they love to sort of do Escher spoofs. So it's really sort of ingrained in popular culture. And I'm sure if you haven't heard the name M.C. Escher, you have at least one of his images in your mind already.
Yeah, I'm thinking of you spoke of the patterns on the tiles, the birds, you've
yes.
got some dark, some light, but their images are forming together. I guess you call that tessellation? Is that?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. And we're so excited that he worked so much in tessellation because that's something that school groups oftentimes work with. And so it's a great excuse to bring in a lot of students into the museum to talk about art and to talk about math.
Hmm. Yeah, those are two worlds you don't often hear put together. And mathematicians, I guess, had a great respect for him as well, as you mentioned. I read something, I think it was from, a university professor in England saying something about believing that the universe may be Escher-shaped. In other words, he got it exactly. I mean, he understood cosmology. He understood the way that things fit together, patterns.
Yes, it's so amazing. And you see that sort of taking shape through the course of the exhibition. He starts working on those tiles, those tessellations, and then he actually confines it to a circle. And he's thinking about how an image can sort of spread out in the circle and become infinite within a circle. And the way he does this, I mean, mathematicians were so impressed. He got it right.
Hmm.
And it does, in some ways, sort of represent the cosmos.
Mm-hmm.
And to do that with no background in math, science, it's really just sort of figuring it out visually is so incredible.
And it's a great favor to mathematicians, I think.
Yes, absolutely.
he shows people, the casual viewer, that it can be beautiful in some kind of way.
And accessible.
Now, why do you think Escher's work fits into the realm of science fiction and fantasy stories so well? He's very popular in that set as well.
Yes, I think that really relates to the work that he was doing closer to the end of his life, those impossible constructions. There's a staircase that he represents that you see in, like, the movie
Inception.
Inception. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You're going to have to master a few tricks if you're going to build three complete dream levels. Excuse me.
What kind of tricks?
In a dream, you can cheat architecture into impossible shapes. That lets you create closed loops, like the Penrose Steps, the infinite staircase.
So I think that that it's grounded in that realism that he had studied so well early on in his life, that it seems accessible. It seems like a picture that you could walk right into. But then there's always that illusion. There's always that element of surprise that I think that people who are interested in science fiction can really latch on to there.
And maybe to help listeners get a kind of visual cue, there is this Sprint commercial. The quarterback, Peyton Manning, is trying to find a receiver in this maze of Escher-like steps. And I look at some of these pictures, some of his images of, like stairs connecting to towers, and it reminds me of very early video game imagery as well.
Yes, there are even now today, there are apps that relate so perfectly back to what Escher was doing. It's these basic ideas about exploring spaces and the way architecture works and how sometimes it can surprise you. I think these ideas are still so relevant today.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you. Why is his work still relevant? Why this show now?
Well, that's a great question. I think he captured the public's imagination back when he was alive, and he lived until 72. And there still seems to be this fascination with the ideas that he was working with. And I'm not sure if there's something that's particularly relevant to 2014, but I think it still fascinates in the sense that it seems so real, but there's that element of surprise. There's the mind-boggling mm-hmm. component to it.
Well, Jane, thank you so much for talking with us about M.C. Escher. You've got me hooked.
I can't wait to see you at the museum.
Jane O'Neill is the Currier Museum of Art's senior educator, and she worked extensively on the M.C. Escher Reality and Illusion exhibition that opens this Saturday, September 20th. It's going to be on view until January 5th at the Currier Museum of Art in Manchester, and you'll find a link with more information that's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And we're staying on the math beat, this time with a look at a staple of high school calculus courses, the Texas Instrument Graphing Calculator. We're going to find out why the design has remained largely unchanged while other handheld technologies get smaller, faster, and cheaper. That's when Word of Mouth continues in just a moment.